Liverpool, England. Crossing the Mersey River today is quite different from those noisy days back in the mid-50s. Then it was an industrial seaport where large ocean liners were being built, and it served as a port of call for ships from around the world. And over there, well, the city was dull, damp, and dirty. Not the creative environment you would expect to inspire the world's most influential pop group. It was largely a working-class city, raising a generation not content to finish its education and take the traditional jobs. They wanted their freedom and independence now. And it showed in the way they acted and in the way they dressed. They wore their British tough boy clothes of the day, known as the Teddy Boy look. Crepe sole or winkle picker shoes, drainpipe pants, long draped jackets, and slim gym ties. Their hair was long and greased back in the Elvis Little Richard style. And they were drawn to the aggressiveness of rock and roll, a lot of which was brought into Liverpool by the ships from America. One of those disaffected teenagers growing up in Liverpool was John Winston Lennon. Born during a heavy air raid on October 9, 1940, John's parents separated when he was a baby. So his aunt, Mimi Smith, became his guardian, though his mom, Julia, came to see him often. She was happy and carefree and a big influence on John. She was the complete opposite to Mimi, the disciplinarian. As with everything, John had to be the leader, whether on the street in gangs or later when he formed his first musical group. His interest in music began while listening to various pop shows on the BBC. The first records he liked were such things as Johnny Ray's
"If Your Sweetheart Sends a Letter of Goodbye."
The Crew Cuts
"Shaboom, Shaboom."
And even Hank Snow.
"I've told you, baby, from time to time, but you just wouldn't listen. No pain in your mind. Now I'm moving on."
But he didn't take notice until he heard
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. But you should laugh right."
Bill Haley in the comments doing "Rock Around the Clock." Another big influence on John was a style of pop music that was very big in Britain at the time and in which everyone was getting involved. It was called skiffle, and its first star was Lonnie Donegan.
"Well, about the time of rock and roll in Britain, I think I was about 15, so it'd be 1955, there was a big thing called skiffle, which is a kind of folk music, American folk music, only sort of jing 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 with washboards. Mm-hmm. And all the kids, you know, 15 onwards, used to have these groups, and I formed one at school."
But probably the most exciting event to affect John Lennon was the appearance of Elvis Presley.
"Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel. So lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely."
John has said that when he heard Elvis for the first time, he thought, "This is it."
"Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, well, be so lonely."
At school, John was far from perfect. His headmaster explains.
"I was certainly very interested in him. To me, of course, he was an acute problem to all my colleagues."
He received his first guitar from his mother. He tried to learn some basic chords, but as with most things, he became frustrated and had his mother teach him. But she showed him banjo chords because that's all she could play. Back home, Aunt Mimi wouldn't go for John's guitar playing. Constantly, she would tell him,
"The guitar's all right for a hobby, but it won't earn you any money."
John and his friend Pete Shotton formed their first group, the Quarrymen, in early 1956, named after the school they attended, Quarry Bank Grammar School. It was supposed to be a skiffle group, but more and more, rock and roll kept creeping into their repertoire.
"Oh, well, come on, everybody, let's skiffle together tonight."
One day, a friend of John's, Ivan Vaughn, told a classmate about their band. His friend was fairly accomplished on guitar and, of course, loved rock and skiffle as much as they did. His name was Paul McCartney, born on June 18, 1942. Paul was always musically inclined. His first instrument was the trumpet.
My dad bought me a trumpet, and I tried to play trumpet and learned the Saints and a couple of things. But my lip was going funny, and I realized I wouldn't be able to sing while I was playing the trumpet. I liked singing, so I traded that in for a guitar, which was a right-handed one. I couldn't work out how I couldn't play it, so I turned it like the right way, and amazingly, upon amazing, it felt good, you know, and I could actually, I was strumming with the right hand now, the correct hand.
On June 15th, 1956, he went with Ivan to see the Quarrymen perform at an outdoor party at the Woolton Parish Church. When he heard them, Paul was impressed, though he laughed at all the mistakes they were making. John was singing the Del Vikings' Come Go With Me, but he didn't know the words, so he was making them up. After the performance, Paul went back to see them. He showed them a couple of numbers that he had just learned himself. One was 20 Flight Rock by Eddie Cochran.
Ooh, well, I gotta get over the record machine when it comes to rockin', she's a queen. We love to dance on a Saturday night, all alone where I can hold her tight, but she lives on the 20th floor of town. The elevator's broken down, so
John played some new pieces that he knew, and then Paul came back with a song he had written himself. At that moment, both of them probably realized their potential, even if John was a bit tipsy from all the beer he'd been drinking. To John, the next step was obvious, to have Paul join the group. He thought that Paul was a great guitarist, but knew that he'd have to watch him because he was the kingpin. John knew that Paul was too good not to have in the band. The next day, Ivan saw Paul bicycling up in Woolton and asked him if he'd like to be in the band. Paul said yes, and so one of the greatest musical partnerships began.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
When Paul joined, he played lead guitar. But at his first performance with him, he blew his big guitar solo, and this seemed to level things off for John. He could see, however, that Paul was more musically advanced and was always a couple of chords ahead. Paul wanted to perform some songs that he had written, so John, not to be outdone, immediately began to compose his own tunes. Their early material wasn't much, really, very simple and similar to songs of the day. But what was important was the effect they had on each other. From this point on, they never stopped.
We used to just sag off school together and kind of go back to my house and we'd go where there wasn't anyone in the afternoons. And we'd go there and smoke Twining's tea in a pipe, one of my dad's pipes. And it didn't taste bad at all, actually. And, you know, we'd sit around smoking that stuff and have a little bang on the piano. We had a stand-up piano by then. And we had guitars, and it was mainly kind of Buddy Holly stuff because he had the least chords.
Oh, hell, the little things you say and do make me want to be with you. Rave on, it's a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me reeling when you say I love you. Rave on.
On the daily hour-long bus ride to and from the Liverpool Institute, Paul met a younger student named George Harrison. They talked about school and other things, but mostly about music, rock and roll, skiffle, and especially Elvis. George was born in the middle of the war on February 25th, 1943. He was never really interested in school, and his rebellious nature came out first in his unorthodox clothes. He found a creative outlet in playing the guitar.
56, I think, was when I first got a guitar. That was the same time I met Paul McCartney in school, who I found out because he used to live near me. I used to meet him because we used to take the same bus ride home. And after hanging out with him, I found his father used to have a little band, you see, so there was a bit of music in his family, so he had a trumpet, and so we used to just hang out and try and play when the Saints go marching in.
Black slacks, make it good, Eddie-o. When I put them on, I'm ready to go.
In 1956, when George was 13, he formed his own group called the Rebels, but it lasted only for a short time. He sat in occasionally with other groups until Paul, his friend at school, asked him to join the Quarrymen in 1958. At first, John was opposed to George's joining because he was so much younger than the rest. But when John asked him to play Bill Justice's Raunchy, he knocked him out with his playing, and so George was in. About this time, the skiffle boom was on the wane, and the boys were down to playing just rock and roll. The members were constantly changing because they couldn't take John's attitude, or they felt left out. George, Paul, and John. It was now their band. One of their first big engagements of this new combination was at the Casbah Club in Liverpool. And at this point, they changed their name to Johnny and the Moondogs.
We did one talent show thing, which we were called Johnny and the Moondogs, which was really just John standing at the front with no guitar singing, with Paul and I just playing guitars at the back doing ba-ba-ba.
John and Paul actually appeared briefly as a duo at this time, calling themselves the Nurk Twins. Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. By now, John Lennon was at the Liverpool Art College, specializing in lettering. He had left home and was living in a flat near the college with a fellow student, Stuart Sutcliffe. John and Stu had a mutual admiration for each other. John admired Stuart's great artistic abilities, and Stuart was impressed with John's band, who played at the college at lunchtime. When Stuart sold a painting for £60 at an art exhibition, John convinced him to use the money to buy a bass guitar. Stuart had always wanted to be part of the group instead of just hanging around with them, so here was an opportunity for him to join. Another classmate at the college, Bill Harry, who later started the Merseybeat newspaper, explains.
He managed to get one of his paintings sold at the John Moores exhibition and get the money for the guitar in the first place. To me, it was very strange. He became in love with the Beatles and enraptured by them, wanted to become a member. And yet, I knew it was doomed to failure right from the beginning because he was such a great artist.
There was another problem. Stuart couldn't play his bass guitar, but John said he'd teach him. In photographs of those days, Stuart usually stood with his back to the audience so they couldn't see him fumbling about. It looked as though John, the bass teacher, wasn't doing his job. Or maybe Stuart just wasn't meant to play it. At this time, the band decided to call themselves the Silver Beatles. They had always liked the name Buddy Holly and the Crickets. John especially liked the name The Crickets. The closest thing to it was Beatles.
I was looking for a name like The Crickets that meant two things. And from Crickets, I got to Beatles. And I changed the B-E-A because it didn't mean two things on its own. I changed the A, the E to the A. And it meant two things then. It was Beat and Beatles. And when you said it, people thought of Crawley things. And when you read it, it was Beat music.
They played off and on for a year or two until Larry Parnes, a big British promoter, came to Liverpool to audition bands to back Billy Fury, a very popular star of the day who was also from Liverpool. Billy and Larry Parnes were impressed with the Silver Beatles, but would give them the job of backing Billy only if they dropped their bass player, Stuart. John, Paul, George, and Stuart were very loyal to one another, so they turned down the offer. But Larry Parnes didn't forget them and offered them a tour of Scotland backing another British artist, Johnny Gentle. Of course, Stuart went along, but he didn't get paid by Parnes.
Well, bebop, Luna, she's my baby. Bebop, Luna, I don't mean baby.
Throughout the next months, the band played various venues with and without drummers. And at one time, they even backed a stripper playing such ditties as It's a Long Way to Tipperary and Summertime. On their days off, they'd go into Hesse's music store and visit Jim Getty.
You know, they used to come in there, just everyday chaps, you know, you just get to know, hey, come in, hello, Jim, you know, hello, George, hello, John, you know, and they sat another and have a chat. I said, yeah, do you want anything? Oh, just have a look around, Jim, you know. By the way, they pick a guitar up and the way they go, you know, and have a little go and have a little practice. And when they heard about the skiffle, of course, the rock and roll started, and then they all sort of wanted to learn to play the guitar. Hundreds of people went down the guitar all at once, of course. I used to teach every Monday night in a little shop just along the road in Whitechapel. And between 6 and half past 7, we had all sorts. We had Jerry, we had Beatles, we had at the foremost, and almost every group, everybody who's been playing, who come, made the top, you know, they all come to for lessons, you know, everybody bought a guitar. They used to give them free lessons. 50, 60, 70 people in one night, you know, learning the basic chords of the guitar, and I used to have a big blackboard and write six lines as if they were wires, and big dots here, and that's the key of so-and-so, that's the key and so-and-so. Now we'd sing a song, and we had a right. Every Monday night, it got very, very popular.
Alan Williams, their off and on again manager, ran a couple of clubs in Liverpool. One day, a Caribbean steel band that played in one of these clubs was offered a lot of money to perform in Hamburg. This intrigued him, so he went to visit Hamburg himself with a tape of some Liverpool bands.
I told him that the groups were the best in England, and that they were very famous groups, and he could have them with tongue in cheek in those days, because the Beatles used to be waiting for five bob a night and 10 bob a night. I said, it'll cost you £100 a week, plus my commission of £10.
Through this connection, the Beatles were eventually offered a job to play there, but they needed a drummer. Pete Best was the son of the lady who owned the Casbah Club. When it opened, the Quarrymen played there quite often. In August of 1959, Peter began to play the drums. Ken Brown, a former Quarryman, asked if he could form a group with them, and they became the resident band at the club. Eventually, the group disbanded, and in August of 1960, Paul McCartney phoned and asked if Pete would like to join the Beatles for their job in Hamburg. So off to Hamburg went John, Paul, George, Stuart, Pete Best, Alan Williams, his wife Beryl, and their friend and cohort, Lord Woodbine, all in Alan Williams' small van.